Blog Talk Radio.
Performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth in Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest LA-based performance artist, writer, Heather Woodbury. Hey, Heather, thanks for being on the show.
Howdy.
A big howdy to you. A native of Northern California, Heather Woodbury moved to New York City at the ripe old age of 17 and became involved in the East Village performance art scene, where she founded the alternative performance art space Cafe Bustelo. She went on to create, she then went on to create masterful and novelistic performance pieces such as Tale of Two Cities, An American Joyride on multiple tracks, and Whatever, An American Odyssey, which the New York Times described as having the scale of a Dickens serial and the melodramatic punch of The Young and the Restless. Winner of an Obie Award, a Kennedy Award, the Spalding Gray Award, and Artistic Director of Fomenting Arts Unlimited, Heather's most current project is entitled As the Globe Warms. You know, Heather, I wanted to start out, And this was actually something that kind of came in through the back door as I was putting your bio together earlier. Mm-hmm. I noticed the word American in a couple places, Tale of Two mm-hmm. Cities, An American Joyride on multiple tracks, and Whatever, An American Odyssey. And, you know, I was wanting to ask you about what you feel about these pieces or your work in general that you consider to be American, and also what it means to you to be an American artist.
Right. Well, I think that's a great question. And then my current piece, As the Globe Warms, I sometimes bill as a new American soap opera, and sort of describe as what it's like trying to survive in today's America on a planet on the edge of climate crisis. So, I think I was even just, you know, contemplating moving to Canada recently and thinking, like, I don't know, I'm pretty American. And Canada's not that different, you know. So I think my work is pretty obsessed with America. I guess one thing I think you and I have talked about before is just, redemption from some of the kind of uglier parts of America in the kind of warmth and richness of experience in America, of all the people and the voices and the regions. So that's definitely one element of what I do, is sort of trying to gather and synthesize all of these voices that somehow reflect for me a kind of patriotism that I have, which is really for the land and the way that the land and the places, it could be a really urban place like New York City, create the character of the people here.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And that love of land and animals, for that matter, really comes out in your most recent work, As the Globe Warms, which we will talk about in a little while. Take us back to the early days, if you will. Ripe old age of 17, you'd left Northern California. You're in New York City. What were the things inspiring you at the time, be it the music, art, theater? And how did those things propel you along your artistic journey?
Well, I mean, I think I got there just, fired up to be both a writer and to be an actor and be in the theater. And And then I started working in CD bars to support myself. And and all of that sort of came together in a nice mashup. So I guess what I'll say is that I sort of quickly got a little disinterested in just sort of straight up doing a lot of theater stuff, and got more interested in the kind of performance art, punk rock kind of vibe. And there were a lot of people who were performing, you know, doing all manner of performance art, from spoken word to, you know, thumping around with bowling balls on their legs and being naked and stuff like that. So that's sort of like the opposite, more visual, spectacle, self-sacrificial end of performance art. But so there were all sorts of people.
Yeah, you were actually coming up around that time in New York, I believe. There were some heavy, I mean, you sort of were sort of finding yourself in the company of some heavyweights at that time, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think I got educated by just sort of osmosis, you know, not even necessarily knowing who all these people were, or who, also you would be seeing a lot of people that were influenced by a lot of people, you know, so, you know, I've just recently sort of officially discovered, for instance, you know, the great Polish actor, director, theater theoretician, Grotowski. But, you know, I sort of realized like everything that was happening in the East Village was influenced by Grotowski. There were a lot of like Eastern European refugee artists performing there, you know, and they were just sort of everybody, you know, there were just sort of people doing stuff that was inspired by the bad sitcom TV that they'd grown up with. There was, you know, I sort of used to just say, you know, I wanted to be like a musician at that time, and just all you needed was a microphone and a light shining on you, and you could do a performance. And that to me was kind of a revelation, you know, rather than going and auditioning for a play that I didn't necessarily really want to be in. I sort of was able to fuse the writer part of me with the performer part of me, and, you know, try a lot more kind of crazy experimental stuff. And
so
thus,
would you say it was these interests that helped you to eventually create Cafe Bastella?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I always love sort of, you know, having people over. Ever since I was like little kid, I like to throw tea parties and have big imaginative, you know, sessions where we would make up some huge game and I would, you know, boss everybody around about what parts they were playing. So, I'm sort of bossy and I enjoy being an impresario. So I think that was also just sort of a way for me to find my own scene by making one and sort of bringing together strands of, you know, some of these very kind of old guard, avant-garde people, and then all the young Turks, you know.
Sure.
So, yeah, we had everything. We had fire eaters. This was a little performance space I started on Avenue B, by the way. We had fire eaters. We had poets. We had musicians.
Nice.
We had, you know, people doing plays, everything, you know.
So. Nice. Now, somewhere in the midst of all this, you began to create Whatever. Is that right?
Well, I started doing pieces in the early 80s where I would sort of write and perform them at the last minute. And eventually I kind of realized that this was my method. It wasn't only my madness, you know, that it wasn't just that I was screwing up and procrastinating until the last minute, but that I actually enjoyed something that would happen improvisationally when you didn't quite know what you were going to do. In the 80s, I probably created about 14 pieces that were, you know, anywhere from a half an hour to an hour long, and that all kind of, you know, would have me sort of playing different characters, but also kind of doing stuff that was more visual poetry, and that was kind of more abstract and performance art stuff, and that would sort of all swirl around a theme, but there wouldn't be any really realized narrative. There might be a sort of suppressed narrative. Friend once described it as stream of consciousness with a suppressed narrative. Anyway, at any rate, in 94, so sort of, you know, after I'd been doing this for 10 plus years, my great friend Dudley Saunders said, you know,
who was on the show like last week, actually.
I noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, he said, why don't you, he sort of dared me. He said, why don't you, since you like to do this last minute stuff, why don't you write and perform a new show every week for a year? And so I modified that length to 9 months and got a musician friend of mine, Latch, who ran the Fort, to give me sort of the opening slot every Wednesday night. So I would come up with a new half hour, and this was terrifying, and I rapidly discovered that it was easier if you told a story.
Right.
So I basically tricked myself into writing a 19th century serial novel.
Yeah, I saw you in an interview talking about that, and in fact, I have it right here. I love that idea, how you sort of use these performances as a way to trick yourself into writing a novel, basically.
Yeah, and then I found out later when I was performing the piece that came out of that, whatever, when I was performing that in London at the South Bank Center as part of Laurie Anderson's Meltdown Festival, which I was extraordinarily fortunate enough to get into, these London journalists told me, well, you know, Charles Dickens used to read off, you know, the latest installment of his serial novel in the back of a pub. And, you know, Dickens was apparently very theatrical, like he sort of acted out his stuff. So I was very chuffed, as the British say, to find out that I had sort of taken a page, as it were, from Dickens himself. So,
nice.
But yeah, but I just to stress, my stuff is not, there's no narrative voice. It's all people running around talking to each other. So.
Right. But there is a story arc, but yeah, it's
oh, there's, it's definitely a, it has a story or the structure of a novel, but it doesn't have the inner landscape or the narrative, you know, voice of a
right.
novel. It has the narrative right. of a novel, but not the narrator. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and earlier you mentioned poetry, and you know, that's been something that's always struck me about your work through the years. And, you know, especially with Whatever, which was the first work of yours that I saw, Skeeter, one of the characters who kind of had this sort of Skeeter surf speak, Southern California dude kind of language, but it was sort of a language all his own and very much driven by poetry and some of the other characters in Whatever as well. You know, I could see, wow, there is a certain foundation of poetry here. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about poetic elements of your work.
Yeah, well, I think in Whatever, I had these rave kids, and so I did have them speaking this kind of North Coast, quasi-Elizabethan, you know, moments of almost Elizabethan English. And then also, whenever they were in an actual altered state, possibly on drugs, I actually had them speaking in rhyming verse.
Right.
So that was just like literal silly poetry. But yeah, I think there's always been sort of elements of heightened language in my work. And, you know, of course, officially all dramatic writing is actually poetry. That's the category that it falls under. But in my newest piece, As the Globe Warms, I find that there's less of that. I have more kind of prosaic speech going on for the most part, and not as much wordplay. But
any particular reason for that, or?
I think it's what I was just about to elaborate on, which is that the poetry is found in these sort of moments where I become elements of nature. So, for instance, I become the ocean by just using a bed sheet, and then I, you know, maybe I mimic dolphins bopping around in the ocean, or I would basically just choose different endangered animals to be every week. Not hard, unfortunately. And so I think the reason for that is that there's a kind of visual poetry that I was trying to get out, a kind of poetry beyond words, and trying to sort of express beyond words this eternal and other life that goes on around our human drama, and that is sort of almost an inexpressible poetry, you know?
Right, right.
I think there's a way in which I'm sort of trying to get at whatever drama and comedy and absurdity and tragedy happens in our lives, there's something else quite beyond that that we ignore at our own peril.
Yeah.
And not only our own peril, but, you know, it is us. It is what we are of.
You know, when I first saw Whatever here in Los Angeles some years ago, I was completely amazed by so many aspects of your performance, but especially, you know, how you were able to slip from one character to the next so effortlessly. And, you know, this ability continues throughout all of the work of yours I've seen. And I'm curious, what kind of preparation goes into being able to achieve something like that, being able to keep all those voices and identities straight in your head?
Well, I think it's basically like an adult game of pretend. I think it's basically something we are all inherently able to do, but I've taken it to an adult level. In other words, I practice. And the stakes, the dramatic existential stakes, if you would, are adult stakes, you know. But essentially, I think it's that sense of play that you have as a child when you're just running around, you know, letting yourself, you know, be all these different creatures and, you know, having a long conversation with a piece of wood, or, you know how children are. They could just animate anything. So I think it's sort of like that. I've also just recently kind of been realizing that I'm kind of like a puppeteer, except I am my own puppet.
Right.
And I think the distinction between what I do and what maybe many other multiple character solo artists do is that I do tell these sort of stories and create these worlds, and I have a lot of every piece I create, I get more and more carried away with having many people talking at once. So I do these like crazy crowd scenes. And so I sort of realize like it's sort of like I am the book, or I like my work is very plain. There's just a microphone and a couple chairs. So in that way it's anti-spectacle. But the spectacle is kind of the lack of spectacle. Do you know what I mean? Like the spectacle that I'm doing it. And so I am the HBO serial, or I am the book. So much that I'm doing it. I am it. That's this sort of weird thing. It's almost like myself and the audience are witnessing it together. We're kind of actually conjuring it together. So it's sort of akin to having a story read to you when you're a kid. I mean, I think one of my favorite compliments that I've gotten from a number of people is just that they went home and they kept remembering the show and seeing several people on several different faces on stage at the same time, you know, and saying, that can't be true. It was just her up there. So that's, I think, like my favorite compliment that I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned that childlike imagination earlier, and I totally get it, and I totally agree that you have that in your work. Is that, I don't know, you know, as you get older, is that something that you find that becomes, you know, more difficult to hold on to? Does it become easier in a certain way, or how is that for you with your state of imagination?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I don't think, I mean, certain things do become more difficult as you get older, partly just because you might be repeating the same mistakes or the same.
Right.
But I don't feel that at all in terms of imagination and play. I mean, I did notice with this most recent piece with As the Globe Warms, especially partly because I've been teaching, and doing some, you know, mentoring and guiding of other people in their work, that that I had kind of delineated what the elements were that I used. And so I found myself in a certain way going back to my roots, like using sort of my 1980s performance art tricks in a kind of more conscious way.
Right.
If anything, I feel like I just returned to the play, but with more consciousness of the play, you know?
Right.
And the thing to me that, I do notice that there's just more deliberateness. You know, I noticed the work coming out of me more wholly, as I wrote it, and just feeling very like, I want to keep these words. I like these words, you know, like,
right.
like a little bit more attached to stuff as a writer, and maybe in that way less improvisational. But I'll tell you what gets harder with age. It's just the physical athletic difficulty of doing it. But then, of course, it gets satisfying with age, too, that you're like, hey, man, I'm pushing 50 and I can still do this.
Yeah, well,
but you definitely have to, like, jog. You have to jog a lot and eat lots of green vegetables.
Right. No, I mean, it's...
You know,
it's,
you cannot take drugs and stay up all night. It's not allowed.
No. You know, whether it's whatever, Tale of Two Cities, or your most current work, As the Globe Warms, how do ideas germinate, and how do you go about building upon those ideas to create such massively layered storylines and characters?
Well, I think I probably work the way a lot of novelists work, except that I don't have the patience of a novelist. I have to go and perform my stuff in front of people in order to keep going. But
right.
So, but interestingly enough, since people usually first notice about my work the characters and the variety of characters, but what I really start with generally is a theme. Oftentimes it's kind of a political, spiritual, you know, thorn that's kind of under my skin and making me scratch and that I have to get out. And then it's always place, texture, feeling of place. And from that desire to describe and evoke the place come the people who can describe and evoke it. So,
right.
So, you know, As the Globe Warms, for example, started with driving between Los Angeles and Las Vegas to campaign for Barack Obama, after my mother had died, and I didn't really feel like doing anything but that. And I became sort of fascinated by that kind of desert land and the little towns in between. And then I just began to, like, put this urban, sophisticated person there, and that became this scientist character, who was, of course, stuck there because he's researching a particular endangered frog and trying to save it from extinction.
Right.
Its habitat. So anyway,
yeah.
But then what's the really fascinating thing to me is the characters that I don't plan. For instance, you mentioned Skeeter, who's a surf dude in whatever, who says, to give you an example of the language that you were talking about, I think at one point when he's rescued by Native Americans, he goes, multitudes, gratitude, elder dudes. But so Skeeter, this character who speaks in this very funny way, and it was, you know, Skeeter was just sort of like, I had this character, this young girl, Clove, who goes to a rave, and Skeeter was just this guy that I overheard at a rave, and I was like, oh, I'll stick him in, you know. Clove will meet Skeeter, so she'll meet this guy, you know, and then his name turns out to be Ezekiel Christian Fry, a.k.a. Skeeter. And then, so, you know, that was just like, okay, the guy makes like a 3-minute cameo in the piece, great. And then, but it's like the next week he just shows up again. He's like hitchhiking home. And then the next week he shows up again. He gets to his mom's house. And, you know, so it's just like, I love these characters that just sort of introduce themselves to a character that you've already kind of cooked up. And then you're like, wait a minute, who's that? You know? And so with my scientist character in As the Globe Warms, there's like this young evangelical Christian girl who works at the local Queequeg's Coffee, AKA, you know, S Bucks. You know, he just meets her, and for some reason she reminds him of his dead sister, who's this, like, East Village artist, for no good reason. And then, anyway, that was just supposed to be that, you know. But then I'm like, wait a minute, who is this girl, you know? And so I love that. I love the way it's almost like characters introduce themselves into the narrative, and then that's how the layers start popping
nice.
Up, you know?
Nice. So why don't you talk a little about A Tale of Two Cities?
Oh,
what inspired
okay.
that? And then I have a couple other questions about that as well.
Okay, well, yeah. So to give you, like, whatever was kind of a road trip odyssey with all these characters from all over the country who ultimately converge. And then Tale of Two Cities was a much more formal idea. I got this NEA Playwright Fellowship to go to the Public Theater and develop it in New York City. And so part of it just came out of I had relocated to Los Angeles for a few years, and I was feeling this kind of intense nostalgia for New York City, and yet the neighborhood I moved to in LA kind of gave me this intense nostalgia for my childhood, because it kind of reminded me of, like, Oakland, California, where I grew up, but Oakland isn't like that anymore, but Echo Park was at the time. And
right.
Anyway, I just kind of, because Los Angeles is so much less on the street and so many fewer opportunities for me to hear people talking and, you know, sort of be interacting with people, I guess I started to get more interior, and I got kind of fascinated by Los Angeles landscape and history. And so I found out about the story of Chavez Ravine, which was this neighborhood that was, you know, wiped away in order to build Dodger Stadium. And I already kind of knew about all the broken hearts in Brooklyn when the Dodgers left Ebbets Field. And the more I researched it, just the more I found echoes of our own time in it, you know, with, you know, Dodgers, Ebbets Field being replaced by a housing project, and just sort of this, not only something being removed, but the memory of it having been removed, being removed, and these sort of layers of amnesia in American society in the name of progress, you know?
Yeah.
And the sort of replacement of a real neighborhood feeling with a kind of franchise, with a business branded, a brand name, simulacrum of community. And yet the sort of irony of American culture is that the commercial thing becomes, ultimately sort of does become, a community thing, because of course now the Dodgers in LA are a beloved institution. So anyway, so this piece just explores all of these layers. Basically, it's about three generations of people in Brooklyn and in Los Angeles, and how their lives and stories kind of overlap. So it takes place from the sort of 50s up through 2001. And I was developing the piece, you know, a week at a time in installments. And I did six in LA and six in New York, except one of the six in New York was canceled because of September 11th. I was literally performing in a place that was barricaded off by the police and covered in ashes. So,
wow.
So then that whole narrative got woven into the show, which is one reason I like working in that immediate way where you're writing and improvising in front of people every week, because whatever's actually happening gets woven in.
Yeah.
Kind of like live television in a strange way.
Yeah,
like Saturday
yeah,
Night
exactly.
Live, only tragic.
Only tragic. You
Saturday
know, I
Night
saw
Dead.
That's right. I saw a version of Tale of Two Cities here in L.A. that was performed by actors.
Right.
And I'm curious, what went into that? What had you decide to sort of go in that direction with this particular piece?
Well, I mean, I think part of it was the origin of it, that I got this NEA Playwright Fellowship and to develop it at the Public Theater. And then I got this, like, as you mentioned, Kennedy Center Fund for New American Plays Award. So it was sort of That's kind of how I conceived of it as I went along. But I developed most of it as a solo performer. But there were sections of it where literally the voices were overlapping musically. The sort of center person in this piece is this young Mexican-American DJ who's taking all of his family's abandoned record collection and mixing this giant mix for his dead grandmother. So I tried to do with words what a DJ does with music, which is to just keep overlapping all of these themes and manners of speech and, you know, soliloquies with rants, with, you know, dialogue, with, you know. And so it was very musical, and it actually just required, I thought it was better done with a number of people on stage at the same time. I was just also interested, so it was seven actors, I was one of them, each of us probably played about a dozen parts. I was also just right. interested in retaining what is in my work when I'm solo, which is the many in the one, the idea that all of us contain all of us, but doing that with multiple people on stage, like kind of like this giant flag, you know. There was some kind of poetry that I was trying to get at with all those people. And there were a lot of people of color in that piece, too, and I just thought it would be interesting, since sometimes in my pieces, I play people from, you know, every strata of society and every race and both genders. I thought it would be interesting to have people of different races doing that, you know, playing people right. that they looked like and playing people that they didn't look like at all.
Nice. So your most current production as The Globe Warms, I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit, its genesis. And I know you've been doing some teaching in Florida, and in fact the director for that show, Michael Yanni, I believe is based in Miami. Did you come up with the idea while teaching in Florida, or was it before then, or how does that whole timeline work?
Oh, yeah. No, it was way before that. I kind of decided to go back to my roots. So, like, whatever was, you know, created over the 37 weeks of nonstop consecutive performing, you know, half hour a week in the back of a bar. So I found this wonderful space here in Echo Park called Echo Curio Gallery, which is no longer with us.
Yeah, I actually came to see some of your perform your installments there too.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. That was great. It was just a tiny little postage stamp sized place. A really great place with a really open spirit. And you know, big plate glass windows that looked out on the street, because I always like creating my work in basically like on the street, only with a roof and a sound system. So I did that, but I also put a new twist on it, which is that I got it. I decided to have a lot of sections of the piece where people would be talking to cameras, as they do in our contemporary world, you know, having Skype relationships and selfing all the time. And so I decided to put the whole piece on video as I quasi improvised it on stage, and to get online subscribers to fund the creation and development of the piece. So that's what I did. Before Kickstarter even existed, I kind of created my own version, which was called the Mac Everybody Foundation, and asked all the Mac Everybodies to subscribe. And so over the course of basically it was about a year and a half, because I would do 3 months and then take 3 months off and then do 3 months and take care of it. So over the course of a year and a half, I, you know, raised about $10,000 from my supporters and friends, and then I did this piece and I slapped it up online every week, this rough draft. And then my director and I in Miami holed up and cut it, you know, cut about half of the material and rehearsed it and staged it. I did a workshop at his university of the whole entire thing, which is 6 nights long, 12 hours altogether, 12 episodes. And then I premiered it in Austin, and it was during the Hurricane Sandy season. And I, you know, was named one of the top plays of 2012 by the Austin Chronicle and blah, 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 blah.
Nice.
So, yeah, so, yeah, Florida has just been sort of like cropping up in my life a lot. Yeah, I've done some teaching at the Atlantic Center for the Arts. I worked some with Michael students at Florida International University. And then most recently I got this residency at the on the other coast of Florida, the Gulf Coast, at the Robert Rauschenberg Estate in Captiva, Florida. I was invited.
Yeah, you're
to go
doing
there from...
some recording there or something, right?
That's right. Yeah. So now what I'm doing is making a radio play or audio book, whatever you want to call it, of Esglob Worms, and I recorded about three quarters of the piece there in the first month of this year in January there. So that was an amazing, beautiful place. And it was like a great opportunity to just be able to work for a month and be fed.
Where you were actually soliciting people to come in and offer their voices as part of the project as well?
Right. Well, so these parts of the piece that I was explaining to you are me depicting nature in a non-verbal way. And some of these parts are like right at very crucial junctures in the show, like the end of the whole, you know, the shebang. How do you do that on radio? How do you do that in an audio way? And so it came to me that one way might be to have hundreds of voices given their sort of impression of these parts of nature that don't really have a sound, like what's the sound of the sunrise, what's the sound of plants growing, what's the sound of planets spinning in the cosmos, sort of thing. So I thought, you know, since the whole radio play is going to just be one person doing all these voices, it would be interesting to actually have sort of a collective aural poem, aural, A-U-R-A-L, poem, of sort of our collective feeling response of to nature, you know.
Yeah.
I don't even like to say nature as if it's this thing that's separate from us, but I think that's kind of, you know, something I'm trying to...
Well, I saw in one of your interviews or something where I think you said nature is us, but nature is also so much more than us.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're part of it.
Absolutely. So why don't we, you know, have you do something live right now from As the Globe Warms? Maybe you can kind of cue it up if it needs any kind of intro, and then just launch right into it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I've just been rehearsing this section, so that's really the only reason I chose to do it. It's actually it's sort of the grand finale of the whole shebang. It's the 12th episode, and there's a kind of face-off between these rather conservative Christians who want to build a megachurch on this site where the frogs' habitat used to be, and all these people who are trying to save it. And so the people who are trying to save it are kind of camped out there. And some of them are Christians themselves, or these young evangelicals who are quite concerned about environmental degradation. Okay, so I'll just launch right in. This is sort of like a little news segment. Yeah, and welcome back to BNC Bazaar. Folks, we've got a bizarre follow-up to the Queequeg's photograph story, which broke exclusively here on BNC Bazaar.
As we first reported, several people, all of whom were affiliated with a 1974 photograph taken of random customers at the original Queequeg's coffee location, spontaneously and inexplicably resurfaced last month in an obscure Nevada town. Now, in a bizarre new twist, one of the Queequeg's 13, as this affiliated group has come to be known, is shaping up as a key cult figure in a fierce local controversy. Our very own Quimby Quilt is on the scene with the latest. Quimby.
Hey, it's quite windy today, isn't it? Shit. Oh. Hi. Thanks, Joe. Folks, I'm standing here only yards away from a desert encampment occupied by the youthful followers of one Lorelei Jennifer Ray, the enigmatic and quite pregnant teen leader of a bizarre new religiously inspired ecology cult. Battle lines are being drawn as I speak in a hotly contested, yet somewhat tiresome, land use controversy. We're moving over here to the police barricades. Come on, Jake, move the cameras. Okay, where the youthful cult followers are facing off against an immense crowd of rather chubby, red-faced, elderly Americans. For the past several weeks, hundreds of these youths have been turning up here, looking lost and confused, searching for their resurfaced leader, Lorelei Ray, all of them seemingly mesmerized by a freakish Facebook page started in her name. I've got Ashley Smythe here, young cult member. Ashley, tell us, why are you here?
To save the butterscotch frog from extinction?
Butterscotch, yes, but why did you join this cult?
It isn't a cult. We're a movement of regular evangelical youth, and we believe in the stewardship of our planet. We're just here to carry out our moral duty to avert climate change and protect God's divine biodiverse creation.
Yes, of course, that's all very well and good, but we understand that many of you enter into bizarre trance states. Is that correct? And this in apparent emulation of your extremely pregnant leader, Lorelei Ray.
Well, not exactly. God gives us to speak in the tongues of, like, dying out threatened species. It started out with Lorelei on this website called Christ.teen.net last year. God sent her as a messenger and gave her to speak as these voiceless creatures. But now it's gone way beyond that. Now on her Facebook page, we are all Lorelei Ray. God has given thousands of us kids to speak in a nature tongue. That's what we call it now. And it's not just animals and insects anymore, but entire ecosystems. Like, for example, Tiffany, the redheaded girl over there. Oh, yes. Last night, she was speaking as a whole forest in Montana that was being eaten alive by beetles that thrive now in the warmer winters wrought by climate change.
Did she come with Mazatool? Spittle. Was there a bit of spittle?
Maybe a little, but that's not the point. The point is
bizarre. We'll all be going to trance today, Ashley. Do you think there'll be some sort of massive foaming at the mouth at some stage?
Only the Holy Spirit has the answer to that, Quimby. Right now, I can just tell you that me and most of us here are planning on doing whatever we can do to save the Aguas de la Salinita Spring.
Aguas de what?
Brothers and sisters, we can sustain life on this planet. God has given us a choice.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. Oh, no! The wind just carried my scarf away. Bullets! That's a boundary! Catch it, Jake! Catch it! All right, that's it.
Well done,
Heather.
So
that's just a little bit of silliness after all our serious talk.
Yeah. You know, I believe you've had some scientists come to your show, right?
Yeah, I have.
And what were those responses like?
I'm very pleased. The scientists have been really, really, really into it. I had a scientist from NASA come in Florida, and I've had some scientists in Austin who came to the whole entire, all six nights, got a babysitter. And so, I was just really thrilled. For one thing, they said, well, you know your science, which I was so intimidated to write this thing because I'm such a science dunce. And there is actually a lot of science in it, but I did research it. I guess it's interesting, too, that I have a couple of water scientists who are overseeing underground water tables. Like, I have two major supporters who both do that. One does it in British Columbia, one does it in Texas, and which is kind of interesting because I think water is a kind of connective thing here. I mean, you know, obviously as things get drier, water gets scarcer, and water is kind of like the big elephant in the room. So it's kind of interesting that type of scientist in particular would be interested in this. And of course, the frogs need water, so the frogs, the butterscotch frogs, the fictional endangered frog in my show is, of course, has a lot to do with water. I had one scientist say, you know, that in some ways he felt like something like this, or actually this, was more important to him than even the work that, you know, Bill McKibben was doing, even though he loves Bill McKibben. And Bill McKibben, for anybody who doesn't know, is the founder of 350.org, which is doing a lot of Keystone Pipeline activism and the idea being that we can't get above 350 parts per million of carbon, which I think we've passed.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
So I do think it's important to tell stories, you know, and not just didactic ones,
This kind of addresses something that I wanted to ask you. You know, we've got, when we talk about global warming, you know, we've got scientists, environmental activists, lawyers, and, you know, all types of other folks acting as advocates for the environment. You've sort of touched on it, but I'm curious if you have any other thoughts on where do you think imagination and poetry can aid the cause of this issue of global warming?
Well, I don't think, you know, I mean, people need to be touched, isn't even the word that I want to use. I feel like this is like pretty damn holistic issue. I mean, it's about our whole civilization. It's about how we regard human nature, how we regard nature, how we see ourselves fitting into it. And so I feel like all of that has to be addressed, you know. But my other scientist friend, the one from British Columbia, she said, you know, something, she's always sort of arguing with other scientists about, you know, how there needs to be, you know, environmental art, and she's big into visual art stuff on the environment too. And I thought she put it really beautifully. She said, people are either in a state of shock or denial about what we've done to the environment, and we need artists to help us mourn so that then we can act.
Interesting.
You know, so I think it's like you have to sort of feel holistically what it is that we're up against, and the only way that I know of processing that is, you know, involves art, involves, the things that only reach us through our senses and through our hearts, you know. And
yeah, how would you say that working on this project from beginning to where you are now, how would you say it's changed you as an artist, and also changed you in relation to your, you know, your connection with the earth, your connection with, you know, global warming?
Well, thank you for asking that, because that was definitely my spiritual, intellectual aim in doing it, was to change my own relationship. Well, I mean, certainly playing animals has made me less inclined to eating them. I still on occasion do get some free-range animal on occasion, but which we could argue about that all day long. But I, you know, I do not eat nearly as much animal as I used to, partly just because of also the damage that grow, you know, having animals in fields and coops, you know, does to the environment, to the water system. It's not just the cruelty, but it is the cruelty too. I guess it's just the whole thing has just been such a really big, long, wild ride. Just getting the whole thing out of me and getting it together.
Global warming, which isn't. Actually, that kind of goes along.
I wanted
to ask.
I just came back from, for instance, I just volunteered to be a climate reality leader, and just came back from a big training in Chicago. So I guess, I mean, in a certain way, it made me impatient. It made me feel like as I was creating it, I was like, okay, here I am, you know, doing this piece, but, you know, maybe I should just be chaining myself to a coal plant, you know. And in the end, my characters kind of get more and more committed that way. So, I mean, I guess I would say also that we don't just need art about this. We need everything about this. So, I mean, it's like whatever you do, whatever it is that you do, do everything until it just becomes part of the fabric of our lives, until we're all just talking and working to change this.
Yeah.
You know? So since what I do is make up big long stories and act them out, that's what I did, you know, or that's what I'm doing. But I think, you know, I also just feel like go beyond your comfort zone. So it kind of takes me beyond my comfort zone to go and become an activist and go around and be like a mini Al Gore and give the slideshow presentations rather than sort of hide behind my characters. But I feel like I have to take myself out of my comfort zone, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like the issue of global warming, it's an ongoing issue. Do you feel that this particular piece, as the globe warms, that you've brought it to some kind of conclusion, or do you still feel like it's an ongoing piece?
Yeah, I mean, most of my pieces, they're novel length, and they take about 7 years to kind of realize in the culture and get any kind of cultural traction from. So, you know, whatever I started in the back of a bar in 1994, and if I finally got published in 2003, and the New York Times quote you gave was also a revival of the show in 2003. So that's almost 10 years later. So, I mean, it takes me about 7 years, I think. So right now, I don't know what I'm on, year four. So yeah, I'm recording the whole thing, then I'm going to put it out online and try to disseminate it. My previous radio play was, you know, broadcast on some NPR stations and hosted by Ira Glass, so I'm hoping that this one, especially with the proliferation of wonderful broadcasts such as your own, I'm hoping that it will gain some traction online, and I'd like to perform it all over, you know, all over US and Canada and Europe, and so that's basically what I'm working toward, and my other Tale of Two Cities and whatever are published as sort of experimental novels, and I'm thinking about actually just writing this one as a novel and getting it published, or trying to get it published, so.
Nice. We're getting close to the end of our time. What's the best way for people to find out about you online, when you're performing, you know, everything?
The best way would just be to go to my website, which is www.heatherwoodbury.com, and then go to the As the Globe Warms page. That'll give you information about, you know, you can watch the video on Vimeo, and that page has links to that. And then there's also a SoundCloud page, which is just SoundCloud As the Globe Warms. SoundCloud.com As the Globe Warms, which is just a couple of little scenes from this radio play that I've put up as kind of teasers.
Yeah. So So with me today has been writer, performance artist, activist, big-hearted woman, Heather Woodbury. Heather, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been such a great honor.
Oh, thank you, Rich. It's been really great. Thank you.
Yeah. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can also find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be writer and founder of the online literary journal, The Weaklings, Greg Oliar. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.